It felt like years before Kip reached the bridge post. He paused, looking back toward the drafters as Sanson caught up with him. The master was still striking his apprentice, who'd curled into a ball. They definitely hadn't seen Kip or Sanson, but they were also turned toward them. And if they looked up, the bridge post wasn't big enough to hide both boys. Kip looked up. The opposite post on the island side was aflame, and the animals were pushing away from it, but too scared to go back into town, which was also burning. That pushed them against the rail directly above the boys, and against the gap in the rail the horse had made, mere paces to their left. Sanson yanked on his sleeve, pulling him away. Kip launched off the post, splashing awkwardly. His eyes flicked up to the apprentice drafter, Zyman, the boy's head tucked between his arms as his master beat him. But then Zyman stiffened.
Master! Master, wait!
Zyman stood, and his master stopped hitting him. Kip got his first good look at the boy. He couldn't have been more than a year older than Kip, with unruly black hair, dark eyes, and a wide, fleshy mouth curved into a triumphant grin. Even in the moment Kip saw him, Zyman's and his master's skin were filling with red, the swirls like smoke being inhaled, but then compacted until it filled their bodies. Kip turned and swam as hard as he could. There was one metal screen in front of the waterfall to keep boats or swimmers from going over, and a dock and stairs next to it. Sanson was already to the screen, more than 10 paces ahead of Kip. After a few more hard strokes, Kip glanced back. The bridge and the jostling animals blocked much of his view of the two drafters, but as he looked, he saw the master run a few quick steps forward. He jumped, spread his arms wide. A shimmering ball of red Luxon formed between his hands, and as they slapped together, it rocketed forward. The ball caught fire in midair, right before it plowed through the animals on the bridge. The burning missile tore off the railing and blasted a chunk out of the middle of the bridge itself. And then it streaked over Kip's head and smashed the wood stairs above the dock. Now Zyman ran forward. He slapped red hand to red hand, but this time Kip couldn't even see the ball of Luxon, because it wasn't aimed at him. Kip could see again. He was pressed against the metal screen in front of the waterfall, surrounded by scraps and shards of wood, some sections still burning, one great section of the bridge slowly sinking.
Kip! Climb over! We've almost made it!
Sanson was already on the other side of the metal screen.
Kip! Move!
The older drafter's skin was already filling with red swirls.
Don't move, or the next one's coming for your head!
Kip grabbed the screen, but as soon as his hands touched it, he felt little claws scratching on his legs, then more on his back. First one or two, then half a dozen. His eyes clamped shut as he felt the claws scramble onto his neck and then over his head. Kip's muscles locked. He couldn't move, couldn't think, couldn't breathe. He didn't dare even open his eyes. Rats were in his hair. A rat had fallen down the front of his shirt and was clawing his chest. Rats were running up his arms.
Move, Kip! Move or die!
He felt a hand grab him, and his eyes snapped open. It was Sanson. Sanson had climbed back up the grate and was braving the rats to try to help Kip over. Kip shook like a dog, dislodging perhaps a dozen rats, but leaving many more. Still terrified, he began climbing up the grate. He threw one leg up onto the top of the grate, but he couldn't pull himself up. He was too heavy. Sanson grabbed Kip's clothes with both hands. Kip pulled one last time and felt his body rising, rising, and finally rolling over the top of the grate. He crashed into the water on the other side. The current pulled at him immediately. When he surfaced, he thought he heard Sanson. Kip couldn't even make out the words. Then he was at the waterfall. There were ledges running perpendicular to the falls, and the town daredevils would sprint along those and leap over the falls. It was too late for Kip to try that. Kip turned desperately, and his feet caught an underwater rock. The force of the current pushed him forward, and he squatted on the rock, gathering his feet underneath him, flailing his hands to right himself. The pool at the base of the falls was plenty deep, but if he didn't jump far enough, he'd hit rocks on his way down. He jumped as hard as he could. To his surprise, he actually went the direction he was trying. For a moment, there was perfect freedom. Peace. It was beautiful. Somehow, he and Sanson had been floating in the river all night, and now the sun was just peeking above the horizon, beating back the midnight black of one horizon to deep blue, to icy blue, to pinks and oranges that lit clouds like halos. Then Kip realized how fast he was falling. His body was at an angle to the fast-approaching water below. From watching the boulder youths, he knew he had to hit feet first or head first with arms extended, or he would be hurt badly. There was no way he was going head first, so he arched his back and wheeled his arms. Whatever he'd done, it seemed to be the exact wrong thing, or maybe he'd already been twisting forward, because he found himself parallel to the water. He was going to land the most colossal belly flop ever seen. From this height, it might well kill him. Not only that, but he realized that he was falling with the water. All the divers he'd ever seen had jumped out beyond it. The water always glanced off one rock on the way down. He didn't even have time to think a curse before a rock smacked his foot. He threw his arms out as he crashed into the water head first, feeling like someone had just hit him over the top of the head with a board. His arms felt like they'd been torn off, and he'd forgotten to take a breath before he hit. Kip opened his eyes underwater in time to see something big streak down into the water beside him in a gush of bubbles. Sanson. Sanson had hit feet first, but had been spun when he hit the water, so he was upside down. He seemed stunned for a moment, unmoving. Then his eyes opened, but he was looking away from Kip. Obviously disoriented from the fall, Sanson began swimming down. Kip grabbed his foot to get his attention. But Sanson panicked. He thrashed and kicked Kip square in the nose. Sanson turned, saw Kip, saw the directions the bubbles were going, and then saw the blood blossoming in the dark water. He grabbed Kip, and together the boys swam for the surface.
Kip! Kip, help me! We've got to get to shore before we get to the rapids!
That woke Kip up. Within 50 paces of the deep, still area where the waterfall landed, there was another set of rapids so steep they were almost a series of waterfalls themselves. And already the current was getting swifter. Foot aching, head splitting, nose streaming blood, he swam with Sanson. They made it to shore with 10 paces to spare. The boys hauled themselves onto a grassy bank and inspected the damage. Exhausted. Sanson was uninjured, and he looked sheepish.
Sorry, Kip. I mean, about your nose and all. I never liked swimming. Always thought there were things in the deep that'd grab me.
Kip pinched his bleeding nose.
Oh, you saved my life up there. Oh, you didn't even break my nose.
Kip was more concerned about the foot he'd struck on his way down. He unlaced his shoe with one hand and tugged the shoe and stocking off. His foot was sore, and there were some nice scrapes along the top, but when he rubbed it, he didn't think any bones were broken. He began tugging his wet stocking back on, which was hard to do while still pinching his nose with one hand.
I can't believe we got
away.
He had abandoned trying to tie his shoe with one hand. Even as he finished the knot, though, he knew why Sanson had stopped speaking. They were bathed in a harsh red glare.
Shit!
Looking up, Kip saw a red flare hanging in the sky above them, marking their location for the rest of the King's army, who had to be nearby. The flare smoke trail led back to the top of the falls, where the two drafters stood, looking at them. Kip and Sanson had escaped two drafters. Now they had to escape the rest of the army. Kip saw a horseman on the ridge that wound from above the waterfall down to the Sandina's farm. He abruptly forgot about his bleeding nose. The horseman would have to go farther to go around, but he had a horse. Kip and Sanson had to make it down the trail along the rapids and get to the farm before the horseman did. Then Kip saw three other horsemen join the first, and then another. and another. The waterfall kicked up huge clouds of mist day and night, and the valley stayed dark for hours longer than the surrounding country. When the flare winked out, Kip lost sight of both the horsemen and the trail. He stopped, terrified. Broad-leafed plants, slick with the mist, obscured both sides of the tiny trail. One foot set on those, and he would plunge down the rocky incline to the river. In the rapids, he'd be battered to death.
Move, Kip!
One hand still hitching up his wet, heavy pants, Kip began jogging as fast as he could, fearless despite the slick rocks, narrow trail, and death beckoning from every side. There were bodies in the river, caught up in the rapids. Dear old Holum. He and Sanson hit the bottom of the trail at a full run. They rounded a corner, and in the morning sun, saw 30 mounted mirror men, drawn up in battle formation.
We wanted to take you alive.
The Red Drafter's face was crimson.
A drafter with your potential doesn't come along every day. But you've killed two of King Haradul's men, and for that, you die.
You're not really going to crash us.
Gavin brought them over the scrub desert.
Oh, I see. When I'm flying, we're flying. But when we're crashing, I'm crashing.
Gavin banked the Condor to the right so they wouldn't be seen from Garriston. There was still a good chance some farmer or fisherman would spot them. But who would believe a lone fisherman who said he'd seen a giant flying man-bird? If a whole city saw them, it would be a different story. Garriston, despite being the most important port in Tyria, wasn't much. The bay was overfished, the land was hot and dry with bad soil, the Hrothgari governor corrupt, his men worse. It hadn't always been this way. Before the False Prisms War, there had been a vast system of irrigation canals that had brought this scrub desert into bloom, with two or even three harvests a year. There had been locks that fed trade to dozens of small cities up and down the Umber River. But canals and locks required drafters and maintenance. Without either, this land had withered. Punished for the sins of dead men.
Gavin, I'm serious. Are we really going to crash?
Trust me.
She opened her mouth, then shut it. He guessed what she hadn't said.
Because that's worked out so well for me before.
Got anything fragile in your bag?
How bad is this going to be?
Sorry. I should have waited until we were closer to the ground.
Wait, what's that?
Gavin looked west, following her eyes, but didn't see what had made her curious. The land around Garriston was plains and dry farmland, but to the west it quickly yielded to steep, tall, impassable mountains that abutted almost directly on the sea. The Umber River was just on the other side of those mountains. If it could go straight to the sea, through the mountains, it would have been only 10 leagues long. Instead, it had to go east to Garriston, separated from the ocean by fence-like mountains, almost 150 leagues from origin to outlet.
There! Smoke!
Gavin wasn't sure that the Black Wisp was anything more than Karras's and now his imagination. Regardless, it was on the other side of the mountain, so it didn't matter. He was just opening his mouth to tell Karras that, when the Condor passed over one of the foothills. A powerful updraft shot them higher into the air. It took Gavin's breath away. He'd only experimented with the Condor over water. He hadn't even thought about how the ground beneath where he was gliding would affect the air above it. Now that he had experienced it, it made sense. Why else did birds of prey spiral so often in the same places? Gavin had assumed they were good hunting grounds. Now he knew. Updrafts.
Can we make it over the mountains?
From this new height, Gavin looked down.
Uh-oh.
And immediately looked back to the horizon. He was certain that what they had seen was smoke. And for it to be visible from this far away, it could only be one of two things.
Let it be a forest fire. Please, Orholm. We can. But if we do, you're not going to meet the man who is supposed to get you into Haradul's army. And I can't get the Condor back into the air without the sea. I'll have to float all the way down the river.
Gavin, when I see that much smoke, I think red-white. A torch could be burning down an entire city. You're heading out to stop a color white near Rue. These people aren't worth any less than the people of Rue. If it comes to it, there are a lot of drafters in Rue who could work together against the blue-white. These people have no one.
In his mind's eye, Gavin was comparing the land below him to the maps he knew of Tyria. It was surprisingly easy, given that he was closer to the perspective most maps were drawn from than most people ever got. He looked at the mountains, the not-quite-pass through them, and the position of the rising smoke. A thought struck him, with a greater force than mere intuition. He wasn't here on accident. It wasn't coincidence that he was gliding in the one place where he could see this fire, or that he had Karis with him. That was no forest fire. It wasn't a red-white, either. That fire was rising from Rectan. It had been a beautiful town before the war. It was the town where Gavin's son was. Gavin knew it, even though they were so far away there was no way to know it. If Orholm had actually existed, this was the kind of punishment he would devise for Gavin. Or test. Whatever it was a choice. 5 years left, and 5 great purposes still to accomplish. And one of those actually was mostly selfless, to free Garriston, which had been crushed because of him, which was suffering still because of him. If Gavin went to Rectan, he'd have to face that crazy woman, Lena. He'd have to face her son, Kip, and tell him that he wasn't his father. Sorry, you're still fatherless. I've no idea what your lying slut mother is talking about. That would doubtless go over well. They would also be close to Rask Haradul's army, so Karis would open her orders, and everything would get messy fast. All Gavin had to say was,
I've got my orders.
Karis would understand. She'd always been dutiful, to a fault.
But you aren't Karis. This isn't her test.
He opened his mouth to say it, and it tasted like cowardice. He couldn't force the words past his gritted teeth.
Let's go see.
Gavin banked the condor and saw that he hadn't made his decision a moment too soon. It would be a near thing to clear the gap between the mountains. Kara squeezed his hand, and her eyes sparkled. Those jade green eyes with red diamonds in them. For some reason, her joy struck him more deeply than any disappointment could have. That joy was a reminder of 16 years of joy he should have given her. Joy stolen. He turned away, his throat tight. The mountains loomed, and Gavin realized for the first time just how fast they were going. There was no hope of a splashing wet landing here. If the updrafts he'd expected didn't catch them soon, he and Karis were going to paint a large crimson blotch across the face of these rocks.
Or Holum, if there isn't any wind at all, then there isn't any wind to get thrown upward, is there?
He was beginning to draft a red cushion, hopelessly, knowing no matter how big he made it, it would be too little at this speed, when the updraft caught them. They were hurled skyward, the wings of the condor straining. The force was incredible. It was hard to estimate how fast they were rising, but Gavin shortened the condor's wings, both to take stress off them and because Rectan wasn't so far away that they would need that much height. The higher they were, the more visible they were. But it did make him think. With all the height he could get off of mountains, the condor's range was vastly greater than he had assumed. It was a thought for another time. Right now, the problem was to stay low so they weren't visible to all of Tyria and to lose some of the tremendous speed they'd built up. He drafted a bonnet, the same blue Luxon he'd used for himself when he jumped from the Chromeria. It popped open instantly, throwing both him and Karis forward. Then it ripped away almost as fast. When they regained their balance, Gavin tried again. Green this time, and much smaller. He sealed the bonnet to the Luxon of the condor so it didn't tear him apart. It worked, sort of. They slowed a little. Now they were headed downward at merely ridiculous speeds. Gavin struggled to expand the wingspan again.
What can I do?
Gavin lifted the front edge of the wings skyward.
Point up to go up, right?
It was exactly the wrong thing to do. They pitched sharply downward. By the time he leveled off the wings, they were heading straight down. Worse, the suddenness of their drop meant his feet weren't even touching the floor. He had no leverage to push against to continue to manipulate the wings. He threw Luxon up to the ceiling to force his body down and began locking his feet to the floor. But the eucalyptus trees were looming huge. He was too slow. Then he was slammed to the floor. The condor dipped below the height of the trees in a meadow and then began to rise. Heading up and up, steeper and steeper. He finally looked at Karis. Her hands were braced against the ceiling, and the Luxon lines traced from both hands to the back of the Condor. She'd taken control of the tail. It was flared, green, bent up. She'd saved their lives, but her eyes were closed with the effort, muscles straining to hold the tail up against the force of the wind.
Karis, level it off!
I'm trying!
You've already gone too!
Then they were upside down, heading back the opposite direction. Gavin's shirt fell in front of his face, and when he pulled it out of the way, they were leveled off. Upside down.
Don't level off now!
Make up your mind!
Karis was standing on her hands on the ceiling. Gavin locked her in again, and together they turned the wings and tail once more. They were crushed to the floor as the great Luxon bird swooped out level once more, only 20 paces above the trees.
Oh!
Gavin breathed freely for the first time in what seemed like hours. He checked the Condor. It seemed well enough.
Did they see us?
What? Who?
How was she able to see so many things at once?
Them.
Karis nodded. Gavin looked toward Recton. They were only a few leagues east of the town now, and it had indeed been burned. All of it. That meant either an incredibly strong red-white, or something else entirely. And they were looking at the something else. There was a small army encamped around the town. It could only be Haradol's men. Or Holum have mercy.
No. They'd have to stare almost straight into the sun to see us.
Huh. Lucky, I guess.
You call this lucky?
What's that?
Below the town, after the falls fed into rapids and the Umber River's rage finally cooled, there was a group of homes. Almost a village, but all the buildings were smoldering. There was a green drafter, skin filling with power, facing several of King Haradol's mirror men.
That's a child! Two! Gavin, we've got to save them!
I'll bring us down as close as I can. Roll when we hit!
They leveled off, 10 paces above a plain of rock and brush and tumbleweeds. Gavin threw out a small bonnet to slow the Condor again. It snapped open, but this time they were both ready for the whiplash and braced themselves. They slowed down faster than he'd expected. The Condor pitched toward the ground. Gavin flung his hands out, blasting the Condor to pieces. As they fell, he wrapped Karis and then himself in an enormous cushion of orange Luxon. Rimmed with a shell of segmented flexible green with a core of super hard yellow. They slammed into the ground, the orange and green Luxon slowing them before exploding from the force of their landing. The yellow Luxon was formed into a more rigid ball around each of them. Gavin crashed through some bushes, bouncing and rolling half a dozen times, before the yellow Luxon cracked and spilled him unceremoniously onto the ground. He wiggled his fingers and toes. Everything worked. He jumped up.
Karis!
He ran. Karis sprang to her feet, 20 paces away. Her hair was askew, but he didn't see any obvious injuries.
What is it?
She glanced down. There was a rattlesnake at her feet, as long as Gavin's spread arms. A dagger through its head pinned it to the ground. Karis's dagger. As Gavin stood there, mouth open, Karis put a foot behind the snake's head and pulled the dagger out, with her hand for Orholm's sake, not with drafting. Sometimes Gavin forgot how tough Karis was. She wiped the blood off on a black kerchief the black guards carried for such purposes. Black didn't show hard-to-explain bloodstains. She shook slightly as she tucked the kerchief away, but Gavin knew it wasn't fear or nerves. It took a body time to relax from the amount of adrenaline imminent death triggered. Karis didn't blame him for nearly getting her killed. She grabbed her bag and bow case, strapped her Attigan belt around her narrow waist, checked to make sure neither blade nor scabbard had been damaged in the fall, and threw her bag on her back. It was like the sudden violence had reminded her of what she was, and of what they weren't. Back on the ground, back to reality.
Sorry about that. I should have gone for the sea.
If we had, there could have been sharks, and now I'd be wet.
Karis smirked, but it didn't touch her eyes. He wasn't going to reach her now. Work loomed, and her work was dangerous. A job that might well lead to war. A job that might require her to kill or to die. She had to ruthlessly cut away any entanglements that would distract her.
Karis, what's in that note?
It isn't true. I don't expect you to understand, or maybe even believe me, but I swear it isn't true.
She looked at him, hard, inscrutable. Her irises were jade green, but now the flecks of red were like starbursts, flaring, diamond-shaped. One way or another, through means magical or mundane, Luxon or tears, Gavin knew that soon those eyes would be red.
Let's save those children.
Paris ran, and he followed her. They cut back and forth down a hillside dominated by eucalyptus trees, peeling bark scattered on the ground, brush slapping them. Karis cut toward the skinny child, leaving Gavin to save the one facing the red drafter. But it didn't matter. Neither of them was going to make it in time. It was too far to run for the punt, even for Sanson. A cool realization settled on Kip. He was going to die. He was surprised at his own reaction. No panic, no fear, just quiet fury. 30 elite mirror men in full harness against a child. A trained red drafter against a child who'd first drafted yesterday.
When I tell you, run.
Out of the corner of his eye, he saw something flash over the trees, hundreds of paces to his left. But when he looked, there was nothing there. He saw that the mirror men were looking back and forth at each other, as if they'd caught the same glimpse he had.
Now, Sanson, run!
The mirror men hesitated until the red drafter gestured, a quick sign, with military efficiency. One mirror man from each side of the line peeled off and circled around Kip, digging their heels hard into their horses. The red drafter himself rode forward alone. Everything Kip had done with magic so far had been instinctive. Now he needed to do something on purpose. Light was pouring over him. There was green everywhere. The two mirror men circling him were each keeping an eye on him, but they were going after Sanson. The wildness surged through Kip once again, and he felt the skin under his fingernails tear open again as Luxon poured into his palm. A javelin formed in his hand. He hurled it at the mirror man nearer to Sanson. The throw was pathetic. It flew maybe 15 paces, not even half the distance it needed. Kip ignored the man. He had seen the other red drafter and his apprentice Zyman throw fireballs from a standstill. They'd been thrown back from hurling something with so much force, but they hadn't fully thrown it physically. Kip imagined the magic streaking from him as the reds had done. The air in front of him coalesced, sparkling, coruscating greens, from seafoam to mint to evergreen, taking on the outline of a spearhead. With an explosion of energy, it leapt away. Kip felt as if he had fired an overcharged musket. Worse than being knocked to the ground, he missed. The green spear cut the air behind the galloping mirrorman. It crashed into one of the few standing walls of one of the burned-out homes. The wall went down in billows of ash. Kip scrambled to his feet to try again, but even as the air began sparkling green in front of him, he caught something red out of the corner of his eye. He turned toward the red raptor too slowly. Something hot blasted through his hands, scattering the green Luxon he'd been gathering, burning him. The red drafter was advancing toward him, dismounted now, walking calmly, red swirling down into his hands again. Kip held his hands up. This time, a green shield formed, translucent, covering him from head to toe, its weight supported on the ground. The red drafter flicked a finger forward. A spark shot out, trailing a long red tail. It stuck to Kip's shield, burning faintly, its red trail going all the way back to the drafter. Kip panicked, and only carrying the shield because it was stuck to his arms, dodged to one side. A much larger red missile roared out from the red drafter. It followed the tail toward the spark, curving in midair along that line. Kip was blown off his feet and thrown back a dozen feet. He felt the green shield crack, as if it had been his own bone snapping. He lifted himself from the dirt, in time to see one of the mirrormen pursuing Sanson raise his long, sweeping cavalry sword and slash downward in mid-charge. Both mirrormen relaxed, like men who finished their work, and Kip knew that Sanson was dead. He rolled over. The red drafter was standing over him. Kip was faintly surprised by how ordinary the man looked. A long face, dark eyes, roughly cut hair. Crooked teeth revealed by his grimace. He was going to kill Kip, but without passion. Just a man following orders. Before Kip could gather magic one more time, the drafter imprisoned Kip's arms in red sludge, sticky and thick. Kip couldn't move. The drafter raised his bespectacled eyes toward the sun once more. Magic spiraling like smoke down into his arms, filling him with power for the killing blow. A dense indigo dot appeared on his ear, then over his temple as his head moved, as if someone with a lantern letting out a single ray of light from somewhere in the forest was somehow focusing that little beam right on his... Something huge and yellow blasted into the red drafter so fast and hard, it seemed the man had disappeared. The red Lux and sludge holding Kip fell into dust. Kip stood and looked in horror at what had been a man. The red of the drafter's clothes now mingled with his blood, magic and violence mixed, but his entire upper body had been reduced to jelly. Kip looked to the forest. With the boy saved for the moment, Gavin ran toward the mirror men. Karis had headed down the hill to save the other boy running for the river, but she was already too late. The mirror men formed up with surprising discipline and speed. None of these men had bothered to bard their horses. Barding was heavy and awkward and tired the horses quickly, and the mirror men obviously hadn't expected to run into any real opposition, much less drafters. That meant that the horses were easily the most vulnerable targets, but Gavin didn't like killing innocent beasts. Their masters? That was a different matter. He swept a hand in a sharp, hard arc. A dozen blue globes, each half the size of his fist, shot out. The mirrored armor, working like a mirror reflecting light, reflected part of any Luxon thrown against it, making it unravel. That was a big problem for a drafter trying to cut down a horseman with a Luxon sword, but it was only protection, not invulnerability. The thin-walled Luxon globe smashed against mirror armor and sheared open, dumping out flaming red goo that splashed all over the mirror men. Men were crashing to the ground from their saddles, trying to roll and put out the fires. Others clawed at their flaming helmets, cooking. More than a dozen horses continued the charge, though. Even without their riders' guidance, these horses were bred to war, and they ran toward Gavin. Gavin threw green wedges around himself like a clamshell and braced himself. The horses jostled him hard as they charged past, but left him standing. There were only three mirror men left uninjured, all of them men on the ends of the line who'd broken off the charge early. They were sawing their reins, turning tail to flee. Cowards, perhaps, but smart cowards. Gavin flicked fingers at each in turn. Super Violet Luxon was fast, light, and invisible to almost everyone. Like a spider, each dot stuck to one of the men, and then climbed up to the joint in their armor at the back of their necks. Three spiked missiles of yellow Luxon sped along the superviolet spider webs, trailing from those spiders to Gavin a moment later. Three riders toppled from their galloping horses. With all the riders around him dead or dying, Gavin looked down the hill to see how Karis was doing against the last two mirror men. One was already down, and if anything, Gavin was surprised to see that the other was still alive, a fact that would no doubt change shortly. 400 years ago, when it had been founded, the Black Guard had been an Elysian company, chosen as much for their proud relation to Lucidonius as for their martial skill. But when Alita lost influence in the Spectrum, the Black Guard had been forced to abandon choosing on the basis of province, and instead had justified their elite position on function. When a drafter drafted, his skin filled with the color he was about to use. That meant in a fight, a paler-skinned Atashian or Blood Forester drafter was easier to predict. That justification had satisfied the Pareans, who were also darker-skinned, just fine. Since then, Blackguards had been mostly Pareans or Elysians, with Pareans gradually becoming the majority as their political power waxed. But having based their protected status on their fighting prowess, the Black Guard had been forced to accept more than a dozen elite warrior drafters from countries other than Perea and Alita over the last two centuries. Karras had joined them because it was impossible to deny her. She'd sparred with every member of the Black Guard and defeated all but four of them. She was simply the fastest drafter Gavin had ever seen, and after her Blackguard training, one of the most dangerous, and it meant nothing to her. At the rate she pushed herself, Gavin thought she'd be lucky if she lasted another 10 years, probably closer to 5. It was like she was racing him to death's gates. But she wouldn't die today. The other horseman charged her, his sword drawn. Karras stood her ground, only moving at the last second, so that she was directly in the horse's path. The horseman, expecting her to move the other way, was too surprised to change his course. Karras dropped to the ground just as the horse was about to trample her. With flexible fingers of green and red Luxon extending from her own hands and crossed, she grabbed the cinch strap as the horse passed over her. The horse thundered past, and for a moment Gavin thought she'd been trampled. Then he saw her flipped into the air. The Luxon uncrossed and whipped her back toward the still galloping horse. She crashed into the back of the horseman and almost spilled out of the saddle, but she scrambled and managed to maintain her seat behind him. Karras drew her knife as she reached around his head with her other hand. She tore open his visor and buried the knife deep in his face. Karras tried to push the horseman down so she'd land on him, but his foot never cleared the stirrup. Instead of a cushioned landing, she was spun hard backward by his body being yanked from under her, and then hit the ground and abruptly rolled forward. She had the good fortune to land on grass, though. Gavin looked at the boy that they just killed 30 of Satrap Horridal's elite bodyguards to save. He was maybe 15, chubby, awkward, with eyes round at what he'd just seen. The child turned and ran toward the river. At first, Gavin thought he was fleeing in fear, but then he realized that the boy was going to check on his friend, the one Gavin and Karras had come too late to save.
What is the meaning of this?
Damn.
He'd been so concerned about the boy and Karras and what was happening down toward the river, he hadn't been paying attention to what was happening up the road. The man who'd shouted had the same weak chin that seemed to beg someone to stick a fist in it that he'd had 16 years ago, the last time Gavin had seen him. His whole body was quivering with outrage as he took in the carnage that was all that remained of 30 of his supposedly invincible mirror men. But Satrap Hartle's face changed the moment he saw Gavin. He drew rein, even as half a dozen of his drafters and a score of his mirror men surrounded him.
Gavin Guile?
The White was going to kill him. Gavin deserved killing. The presence of Satrap Hartle himself changed everything. If these had merely been Satrap Hartle's soldiers, as Gavin and Karras expected, Gavin could have killed the men and left. Satrap Horridal would be furious and would hunt the drafters who had done it, but he would have no idea who he was after. It might have simply been that there was a powerful drafter living in... what was this worthless little town called? Recton. That was it. Oh, the irony. It was too late to grab the spectacles Gavin kept in a pocket against such eventualities. With spectacles, with what he'd done, he was a mysterious polychrome. Without them, he could only be the Prism. So now, the Prism himself had moved against Satrap Horridal, and there was no denying it. Rask Horridal knew him.
Gavin?
Satrap Rask Horridal was dressed in mail, with segments of plate worked in. Smaller segments, not requiring articulated joints. His was a poor country. He changed his seal. It used to be his family's moon and two stars on a field sable, his personalized with a snarling fox. Now, both fox and field had been done away with. The king's new seal was a white chain, broken, on a black field. Gavin knew instantly that the symbol was important. Rask wasn't merely repudiating his name and his father, whom he'd always despised as weak. This was new. Had he fallen under the sway of the heresy of the old gods that Gavin had heard rumors about? What was he doing? Why was he asking Gavin's name when he already knew it was him? Was he giving Gavin an opportunity to lie, to say that he wasn't the Prism? If Gavin did so, what would Rask Horridal do? Kill him and explain later to the Chromeria that it had been a mistake? Through no fault of his own, he'd killed an attacker who'd disavowed being Gavin Guile. If Rask thought he was going to kill Gavin with a handful of drafters and a score of mirror men, he was wrong, but what else could it be? Maybe Satrap Haradol was simply as surprised to see Gavin as Gavin was to see him, and he didn't know how to play this. If Gavin lied and Rask attacked, Gavin would have no choice but to kill him. If he killed Rask, he'd have to kill all of Rask's men. And what would the satrapies make of that? More men were coming down to the path behind the satrap even now. Gavin couldn't kill them all. No matter how strong he was, if 100 men fled in 100 directions, some of them would get away. Word would get out that the Prism himself had come to Tyria and assassinated the satrap without provocation. It didn't matter that Satrap Haradol was massacring everyone in this town. It was his town. He could do with it as he saw fit. At one time, a Prism could have destroyed or killed one of his satraps at will, but that time was long past. Perhaps back when the seven satrapies had really been satrapies. No longer. His power was ceremonial, religious only. The Prism wasn't supposed to interfere in the internal affairs of a nation, and Gavin had already more than just interfered. If he killed everyone here and skimped back to the Chromeria so he got home within a few days of having left, the Chromeria could plausibly deny that he was responsible. It was too far away for him to have come and gone. He would kill a man he'd never liked. He would stay out of trouble, and the only people to pay for it would be a bunch of soldiers in the most backward of the seven satrapies. Well, the boy might have to die too. Otherwise, he could blackmail Gavin. And what would Karis think? Well, what did it matter what she thought? She was an impossibility for him already. He'd known he was going to lose what little he had with her today regardless. The man he'd once been wouldn't have hesitated.
What would you do, brother?
It had been so long, Gavin wasn't even sure anymore.
I am the High Lord Prism, Gavin Guile.
Gavin bowed slightly, putting one hand behind his back and trying to wave off Karis.
So, Lord Prism, is this how the Chromeria declares war?
Strange that your thoughts should so quickly go to war, Satrap.
Strange? No. It's strange that you should call me a satrap. You expelled the rightful satrap, my father, from Garriston, stole that city, our capital and only port, and have denied Tyria's people access to the Chromeria. Tyria is a satrapy no more, and hasn't been since your war, Prism. I am King Rask Haradol of Tyria. You have murdered my personal guards, and you call it strange that war should occur to us? Perhaps you think Tyrians are bred to be slaughtered by the Chromeria's lackeys.
Gavin realized this kind of talk was nothing new.
But surely the Chromeria wouldn't send the Prism himself just to kill a few of my men.
Rask pretended to be thinking, but didn't wait long enough for Gavin to get a word in.
No. The Prism would only come if there was something much more important to accomplish. Something that would ensure the Chromeria's stranglehold on the seven satrapies continued. Tell me, Lord Prism, have you come to assassinate me?
One doesn't send a lion to kill a rat.
The mirror men and drafters pressed in closer to Rask Haradol. Gavin only heard it. He was looking down the hill. He'd avoided looking until now to avoid drawing attention to Karis. By now, she'd probably decided whether she was going to stay or go. She was almost gone, already starting down the swift-flowing river on a little punt. If Gavin knew Karis, though, she would stop and try to see what happened to him. After all, she was a blackguard, and though her first responsibility was always to the white, his protection came in a close second. He wondered if she'd left because she trusted him, because she thought he could fend for himself, or because she had her own mission to accomplish, and nothing could be allowed to interfere with that. The stout boy, on the other hand, was now almost directly behind Gavin. After Gavin had saved him once from mirror men, apparently he thought Gavin was his best hope to survive.
You misunderstand me, King Haradol. I saw these men slaughtering the innocent citizens of your satrapy. I intervened to save your people. I believed I was doing you a favor.
Doing me a favor? By murdering my soldiers in uniform?
Renegades, surely. Bandits. What sort of madman would burn his own town to the ground?
Many of the mirror men looked away or down, and threw furtive glances at King Haradol. Clearly, not all of them had been happy to murder their countrymen. The king flushed.
I am king! I will not have my choices questioned, especially not by the Chromeria. Tyria is a sovereign nation. Our internal conflicts are no business of yours.
The soldiers went back to being stony-faced.
Of course not. It's simply novel to find a king burning his own town and people, murdering children. You can understand my confusion, I'm sure. My apologies for this misunderstanding. The Chromeria serves the seven satrapies, Tyria included.
It was perhaps as well played as Gavin could manage. If they'd been standing before 50 nobles versed in the interplay of nations and respectful of diplomacy, it might have been enough. Raskorodul would demand some monetary consideration, allowing it had been an honest and understandable error, and preserving his own right to have been outraged, and Gavin would be understood to have won. Elegant and clean. But Raskorodul was a young man, and a new king. He was not standing in front of nobles, but in front of his men. He saw that he was losing, but with the bloody corpses piled on every side and his men looking askance at him, he didn't think he could afford to lose.
Well, surely you haven't come hundreds of leagues simply to patrol our kingdom for bandits. And unannounced, no less. One would think you snuck into our kingdom under the cover of darkness like some sort of a spy.
Ah, not stupid either. When on a losing path, take a new one, quick. Gavin glanced once more at the boy to see how he was holding up. Not well. He was practically quivering with terror. He had eyes only for Raskorodul. Or was that rage?
A spy? How droll. No, no, no. One has people to do that sort of thing. One doesn't do it oneself.
What are you doing here?
Haradol glanced at the boy, and Gavin knew he was lost. He could leave. He was the Prism, after all. And even killing 30 of Haradol's mirror men wasn't enough to justify his seizure or murder. Especially not under questionable circumstances. Rask would risk uniting the satrapies against Tyria. Killing a satrap would be an outrageous breach. Killing the Prism would be an unconscionable one. But Rask felt he was losing, and he was going to make Gavin pay for that. He was going to hurt him as badly as he could. Gavin would be released. The boy would be killed.
I saw smoke. One of the ways I serve the seven satrapies is by dealing with color whites. I came to help.
What are you doing in our kingdom?
I wasn't aware you'd closed your borders. Indeed, I wasn't aware of this new kingdom at all. This seems needlessly hostile. Especially to wish to bar a servant of the realms like myself.
The myth of polite dialogue between disinterested, reasonable neighbors, that myth upon which so much of diplomacy rested, was clearly dead. So, to turn the attention away, Gavin stepped right over its corpse.
Are you hiding something, King Haradul?
You're from Rectan, aren't you, boy? What's your name? Who's your father?
I'm Kip. I've got no father. Most of us don't. Not since the war.
It sent a lance through Gavin's guts. He'd almost let himself forget. The False Prism's war had wiped out dozens of these little towns. All the men, from boys who couldn't grow a mustache to old men who had to use their spears as canes, had been pressed into service by one side or the other. And he and Dazin had sent them against some of the most talented drafters the world had known. Like lumber to a mill.
What about your mother, then?
Her name was Lena. She helped at a couple of the inns.
Gavin's heart stopped. Lena, the crazy woman who'd sent him the note, was dead. This boy, this fearful boy, was supposed to be his son? The only survivor from a town burnt to the ground stood here, and he was the only one who could cause Gavin grief. If Gavin had believed in Orholm, he'd have thought it a cruel prank.
Oh, Lena, yes. I think that was the name of the whore. Where is she?
My mother was no whore! And you killed her, you murderer!
Dead? She stole something from me. You'll take us to your house, and if we can't find it, you'll work for me until you pay it off.
Raskorodul wasn't going to have the boy work off his mother's debt. Gavin had no doubt that Rask was lying about the whole thing. It was merely an excuse to take the boy, who, if Rask was a king, was one of the king's subjects. Most likely, Rask would kill him right in front of Gavin, just to salve his own pride. The boy meant nothing. He could have been a dog or a nice blanket for all Rask cared. He'd become a chit. Part of Gavin was sickened, and part of him reveled in it.
Put me in a situation where I can't win? Really? Do you think this is impossible for me? Let's play. The boy goes with me.
Rask Haradol smiled unpleasantly. He had a gap between his front teeth. He looked more like a bulldog baring its teeth than a man smiling.
You're going to risk your life for this thief? Hand him over, Prism!
Or what?
Threats so often withered when you pulled them out into the light, naked.
Or my men will say how this was all a big misunderstanding. We had no idea that the Prism was here. If only he'd announced his coming. If only he hadn't been confused and attacked my soldiers. Why, we simply defended ourselves. It was only after his unfortunate death that we discovered our error.
No, Rask. There's a reason I don't travel with blackguards. I don't need them. You were just a snot-nosed boy during the False Prisms War, so maybe you don't remember what I can do. But I can tell that some of your men do. They're the ones who look nervous. If your men attack, I will kill you. The White will be furious with me for a month or two. It will be a diplomatic problem, to be certain. But do you really think that anyone cares what happens to the King of Tyria? King, not satrap, and thus a rebel. They'll only want assurances that it won't happen to them. We'll make promises and apologies and pay the tuitions of all Tyrian students for a few years, and that will be the end of it. Your successor will doubtless be less belligerent.
Well, I'm...
But let's pretend for a moment that by some chance you actually killed me without being killed in turn. I see what you're doing here, raising a town so you can raise an army, founding your own Chromeria. The question is, do you think you're ready right now for war? Because if I go back now, armed only with words, the Spectrum might not believe me. But if you kill me, that will be a more elegant testimony than any I could muster. And you really think your version of what happened is the only version that's going to get out? You are a young king, aren't you? And here you were talking about spies just moments ago.
Silence stretched cool hands between them. Gavin had won, as completely as he'd probably ever won a pure argument.
This boy is my subject and a thief. He stays.
Haradol wasn't calling Gavin's bluff. He was simply refusing to lose. Gavin hadn't been bluffing. 9 times out of 10, he could probably kill every one of these soldiers and drafters, depending on how good the drafters were. And he'd probably emerge with nothing more than a singed eyebrow. Protecting the child during such a fight was another matter. Is it better that the guilty should perish, or that the innocent should live? And not all of the 7 satrapies would be quite as quick to forgive as he'd pretended.
He's no thief. He's got nothing but the clothes on his back. Whatever his mother may or may not have done, it's nothing to do with him.
Well, this is all easy enough to test, isn't it? Search him!
From the look in his face, apparently Kip was a thief.
Unbelievable.
Where was he hiding whatever he'd stolen? Between rolls of fat?
No! It's the last thing she gave to me! You took everything else! You can't have it! I'll kill you first!
Gavin recognized the wildness in Kip's voice immediately, even before Kip's irises were flooded with jade green. The boy was going to attack King Haradol, his mirrormen, and his drafters. Very brave, but more stupid. King Haradol's drafters would see it too. Gavin threw his left hand up in a quick arc, forming a wall of red, green, yellow, and blue Luxon intertwined between Kip and King Haradol's men. With his right hand, he drafted a blue cudgel and clubbed Kip over the back of the head. The boy crumpled. A single red Luxon fireball thrown by one of Haradol's drafters hit the wall, and as it plunged into Gavin's shield, it instantly extinguished. Everyone else stood stunned. Gavin released the shield. A few of the mirrormen were looking again at the corpses of their comrades, maybe thinking that their deaths were no fluke. Rask Haradol alone seemed unfazed. He dismounted, walked over to the unconscious boy, and searched him roughly.
Where is it? Give me the...
Raskardl produced a slender rosewood case that had been tucked inside the back of Kip's belt. He opened it a crack, shot a satisfied smile at Gavin, and tucked it in his own belt. He walked back to his horse and mounted.
A thief and an attempted assassin. Thank you for your services in foiling the attack, Lord Prism.
King Haradol motioned one of his men toward Kip.
I think that tree should support a noose. Will you be staying for the execution, Gavin?
So this is where it ends. This is the cost of my sins.
There was no attempt on your life, King Haradul. We both know that. The boy didn't even draft. I was merely disciplining him as a Chromaria student for considering drafting without permission. You have the box, and you've already murdered the supposed thief, his mother. A harsh punishment, to be sure, but this is your satrapy, kingdom. It's obvious he knew nothing of it except that his mother gave it to him. Whatever claim you have to him pales in comparison to mine.
He's my subject, and therefore mine to do with as I will.
You asked earlier why I came to this boiling latrine you call a country. Kip is the reason. My claim to him is greater than yours. He's my bastard.
Raskardl's eyes went stony, and Gavin knew he had won. No man would publicly claim a dishonor if it weren't true. He also knew from that look, before the man even spoke, that he was going to have to kill Raskardl. But not today.
Your time is finished. Yours and the Chromaria's. You're done! Light cannot be chained. Know this, Prism. We will take back what you've stolen. The horrors of your reign are almost at an end. And when it ends, I will be there. This I swear!